continue every Tuesday morning from 5 to 8, playing some things you've never heard before and also playing some old favorites. But we invite you to join us each and every Tuesday as we have an audio family reunion right here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington. Peace.
DC, this is Joni. It is Monday, September 16th, 2024. We have a packed show for you today. Chuck is out. Wishing him recovery from a bad cold. We have two important segments. We're going to kick off the show in a moment talking about a new housing crisis in DC where the mayor has pulled the plug from under a thousand families receiving housing subsidy, putting them at risk for homelessness. We're going to get to that in a moment. And then the majority of the show will be featuring recorded clips from Dr. Greg Carr's program In Class with Carr from this past Saturday. The first segment will talk about his discussion around the November election, third parties, last Tuesday's debate, and more. But we're especially excited about the second half, where he will be talking about James Earl Jones playing Paul Robeson. And he has a lot to say about that that connection between James Earl Jones and Paul Robeson, which you're not going to hear on anywhere else but here on WPFW. So let's jump right into the first topic about this housing crisis. Hopefully, Roach Brown will be joining us for this discussion. But let me just say that this was quite a disturbing development. I'm going to read from the Washington City paper that says it takes a special kind of incompetence or perhaps audacity to manage to piss off the DC Council, the DC Housing Authority, and hundreds of struggling families all at the same time. And yet that is precisely what Mayor Muriel Bowser has managed this month of September. Bowser's deputies have pulled the rug out from under roughly 1,000 families receiving temporary subsidies via the Rapid Rehousing Program, according to lawmakers and advocates. In early September, the Department of Human Services announced plans to send notices to families saying they will be kicked out of the program soon and must pay rent without city assistance. It sent similar notices to another 1,000 of them over the summer. The moves could not only plunge those people back into homelessness, but it also amounts to an about face from this past budget cycle when Bowser struck a deal with both the council and housing authority to find longer lasting resources to help these families. Bowser's Housing Services Department spent the first half of the year warning that it didn't have money to keep participants in the program. With 2,200 families at risk of being kicked out, the council moved money around to fund about 450 new housing vouchers. The mayor's end of the bargain was to keep these people in the program until the city matched them. Tenants advocates were outraged to discover that Bowser was going back on her word telling Rapid Rehousing participants in early September that they'd cease receiving rental assistance by the end of the month. And it goes on to say DHS would only have needed to keep people in the program for a few more weeks until it could match them to this additional subsidy. Tossing families early could funnel them back into the shelter system, where the city will pay almost twice as much to keep them housed anyway in worse conditions. So I'm glad to have Roach jumping in with this discussion. Roach, this is very upsetting, and
yes, it is.
I know you have something to add to the issue that returning citizens are also impacted.
Most certainly. That order by the mayor has really gutted the program for returning citizens. We only have 20 to 30 vouchers, and you got 60,000 men and women in the streets. Every week, 200 people get released from prisons all in D.C., 200 to 300 people. And they have nowhere to go, no housing, no homes. Families died. Guys have served 30, 40, 50 years in incarceration, and we only have 20 to 30 vouchers, Section 8 vouchers for these men and women coming out. And by cutting this program, we were trying to see if they would do what Mayor Sharon Bass did over in California. To bring them, we've been working on trying to find these container apartments and modular units that we can install or erect in less than 90 days, 120 days, and we can address this housing problem. This is a crisis within a crisis within a crisis. Men coming out of prison with no homes, no money, no contacts, no support. Now there's no housing. If you got to go to the shelter, that's like sending them right back to the institution. There's no halfway housing in Washington, D.C. We don't have a halfway house no more in the city. So our men go to Baltimore and Maryland. So that further exasperates a housing shortage. That's a crisis within a crisis. So we need vouchers, housing, emergency wraparound services for those men and women coming out of institutions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Roach, you're absolutely correct. And of course, this is impacting over 1,000 families in general. And the infuriating thing about it is, Roach, to take away these subsidies, it will cost the city twice as much to keep them in shelters. So
that's
it makes
right.
no sense.
That's right.
It makes absolutely no sense. And I'm going to say I'm very angry with the mayor. And I don't know how you feel, Roach, but we're hearing all this stuff about Trayon White taking a bribe. But what? Yeah. Why is the mayor doing this? What Trayon is perhaps did is not impacting people's lives. He spends time for years trying to save lives. But what the mayor is doing is affecting people's ability to live. And for what reason? For what reason? Only two reasons can I think of, Roach. It's either her incompetence or what kind of bribe is she taking? Why is she willing to throw all these low-income people, including returning citizens, under the bridge, you know, under the rug? Why?
When the city... You know, she spent $49 million to relocate the migrant workers, the migrants in D.C., $49 million to house and give them services. And they also get a debit card up to $1,000. Our men and women coming out of institutions does not get that support. They don't have a debit card or get a house.
But Roach, I'm asking the question, which listeners should think about. Why is she doing this? We talk about bribes. Is she getting pressure or money in some kind of way that she's able to legitimize from the developers? Why is she doing this? It's a big question, and I'm angry about it because, you know, I see what they're trying to do to Trayon White, but the mayor somehow gets off scot-free when she's affecting thousands of people's lives and increasing the budget. I just want to read, Roach, what Councilmember Robert White said. It creates all this destabilization, particularly with kids forced to move just as the new school year starts. It costs twice as much for the city to have these families in shelters as to have them on vouchers. We're shooting ourselves in the foot financially. It just doesn't make sense. And then there's been some comments from the advocates, including Amber Harding with the Washington Legal Clinic for the Homeless, They just moved all these families into the program without any plan for transitioning them to longer assistance. I regret to say in the past that this is the worst this program has ever been, because it somehow always manages to get worse. And Roach, you and I are going to have to make sure that this issue is kept on the front page of people's ears and minds and hearts, because we cannot...
We'll keep it on the front of our show, because some messages that's included in this, Joni. We got the homeless problem for youth, with all this youth crime and the carjacking. Yes. A lot of these kids don't have a place to stay. They are sleeping in the streets, under the bridges. They're not even addressing the problem of our homeless youth. We got the homeless youth walking the streets. The whole community, the black community, is suffering every aspect. The seniors, the youth, people coming out of the community, wraparound service for people on Section 8. Everybody's hurting, and yet they can find $49 million and give Ted Leonis $500,000, $400-some million, to keep his team and stuff in D.C., the business district. They can find means for these folks, but what about the least, the lost, and the less of us?
Absolutely. And again, we have to ask the question, why? You know, we know it's racism. We know it's discrimination against so-called disadvantaged people. But the city has money, as you just said, for all kinds of things, yet it doesn't have money to keep people in homes and instead of shelters, which is twice as much. So, yeah. Roach, I we're going to move on in a minute. But
okay. Go ahead, John.
I want listeners to listen to you tomorrow, 10 a.m., every Tuesday at Crossroads with Roach Brown. And I know, Roach, you're going to be keeping this issue on the front burner.
Thank you. We need everybody's help. Please join. Please, we need help.
Yes, and we need to keep coming back to this issue, Roach. So,
okay.
Roach, Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you, Joni. I'm glad
you called in.
And I'm glad you're dealing with this topic. Thank you.
Yes, and we're going to, Roach, we're going to need to expand this discussion in the near future, because I just squeezed it in today. But
all right, Joni, let me know what you need me to do.
Okay, Roach. We'll listen
to you
tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay, again, listeners, I would encourage you to check out the city paper for a fuller discussion of this issue. It's really a disgrace that the mayor could do this, and yet somehow, you know, we have to ask, is there a possible bribe in this issue? Why is she doing it? What does she get from the developers? She's trying to push poor people and more black people and returning citizens out of the city. That's what many of us think.
Okay.
We're going to move on.
You.
Thank you, Roach.
Thank you.
And now we're going to shift gears, and we're going to be hearing two clips for the rest of the show from Dr. Greg Carr, who is a frequent guest on this program and many others. He has, among many other platforms, of course, he's a professor at Howard, but he also has platforms on social media every Saturday. He can be heard on In Class with Carr on YouTube, which is totally free. You could check it out. But this Saturday was very compelling to me, and we're going to be featuring two segments. The first segment is going to be when Greg Carr talks about the last Tuesday's debate. He talks about third parties, and he talks, of course, about the November election. But I want everyone to stay tuned for in about 10 or 15 minutes. The bulk of the rest of the show will be Dr. Carr talking about James Earl Jones playing Paul Robeson. And he does it only like Greg Carr can do, and I'll reintroduce it in a few minutes. But be sure to stay tuned in a few minutes to hear this discussion about James Earl Jones and Paul Robeson with Greg Carr. Let's go to the first segment.
And all my friends who say we must vote third party, I don't disagree with you, except when it comes to understanding what a third party does, friends. Third party doesn't disappear until federal elections and then announce presidential candidates every 4 years. And when the response to that is, no, we're working in between, we're organizing. Okay, show me, because I'm in the streets every day, friends. And third party politics is something I'm very familiar with, having participated in them. And y'all remember the name Lenora Fulani, the black woman out of New York who ran for president. is back in the day when Phil Donahue was riding high. Donahue had Lenore Fulani on his show in the 1980s. Some of y'all probably remember that. But you also remember NB, National Black Independent Political Party. You remember the 1972 Gary Convention. So as someone who wasn't there in 1972, I was 7 years old, but who is well familiar with many people who were. Who is well familiar with the National Black Independent Party and well familiar and conversant and sitting with and listening to and being in debate and argument and discussion and ultimately consensus building with people, everybody from Manning Marable to Ron Walters to Amiri Baraka to Jesse Jackson. Oh, let's be clear, friends. I know what a third party does. You read Ron Walters' book, Black Presidential Politics in America, you understand that party building isn't just about winning elections, it's about building power. And that 1972 convention in Gary, followed by the one following year in Little Rock, and you can read about this in all kind of books. You can read The Defeat of Black Power, or you can go back to the primary documents. You can go back to Black World and Negro Digest and trace those Black political conventions in Gary and the one in Little Rock. You can see that you can come up with a 10-point plan for saying these are the 10 things we think the Black community needs. We've workshopped them. We've agreed to agree on them in the words of Mareeba Kelsey. And now we're presenting them to the Black community on a little card. And you talk to any candidate, independent, Democrat, progressive party, green party, blue party, the after party. And if depending on where they come down on that 10, think of it almost like a pre-Alan Lichtman version of Lichtman's 13 keys. You come down through, and whoever's got the most, that's who we vote for. We ignore the D or the R, or the I, or the G, you know, or the People's Party, the Progressive Party, or whatever. See, political parties don't translate into mechanisms for getting people elected until election time. And when they do, that's state, local, and federal, and in whatever configuration that your votes get emptied into. So when Angela Rye and Jill Stein are debating, are you talking past each other? Because Jill Stein is speaking like an ideologically pure person. And hey, I understand. Angela Rye is speaking like a person who is talking about two-party duopoly electoral politics. Hey, I understand. But we have to be clear about our point of departure. Otherwise, we just talking. And then, of course, on social media, the amplification of weaponized ignorance creates what is necessary for the fascists to prevail. And that is chaos. Now, John Trump won the debate in his mind, but not only in his mind, he won the debate by changing the conversation. Do you know who, if an election poll was taken today, would be leading by an overwhelming majority? Cats. And dogs would be the presidents of the United States of America. If you poll general people and say, what is the one thing in the debate between Harris and Trump that is indelibly in your mind? And based on that answer, that will be the president. Oh, it's going to be cats and dogs. Meow. Not even moo and oink. We done moved past moo and oink. We now at meow and bark. In fact, not even meow and bark, but the ghost of meow and bark, because those pets have been consumed. And Donald Trump, understanding, crazy, in this instance, like a fox, changed the conversation. We laugh our way all the way, having belly laughed and then missed and woke up from laughter on November the 6th to realize that, damn, I didn't vote, but I'm in a safe state. Are you? This is why I asked you proper about Taylor Swift and the impact, because, you know, they've got the polls, the phone polls, the internet polls, and we all know the polls miss significant numbers of people. I read something, and I could not find it in the hour before we turned on here, but I will find it between now and office hours.
I want to say this.
Yeah, please jump in.
I think her endorsement is going to have a significant impact. There are a lot of 20-something-year-olds. And it was the same thing that happened with Barack Obama that blindsided Hillary Clinton, because they had that institutional political machine that, you know, with Bill and everything. And they thought that, you know, and he should wait his turn and they were going to steamroll over him. But he did say he tapped into something that Hillary Clinton wasn't able to do then or in 2016. Young people. That's mm-hmm. the deciding factor. And like it or not, Taylor Swift, I teached it. At Hunter College for 27 years. And it was always 18, 19, 20-year-olds. They love K-pop. They love Taylor. Black, Hispanic, Filipino, Chinese. It's universal. She's universally loved. There's a whole generation of college-age white girls who will be inspired. The fact that vote.org almost got shut down in one day with people going on to register.
How about that?
Who's registering at this point, Dr. Carr? Undecided exactly. people. We had 100 million people that didn't show up in 2016, right? 2020. 100 million. More people sat out than sat in, right?
That's right.
So if we are having an influx of people registering, I believe the undecided people, the people that would never vote or show up, are just tired of the negativity and the back and forth and the confusion and the misinformation. They just are tired.
Yes.
And now they might be inspired.
And this is for all my friends who say it's a duopoly and both parties are the same. You're absolutely right. And with that having been said, you've also revealed through your decision to sit on the couch that you don't give a damn about your grandmother's insulin. And I understand you want to throw granny in the road. But anyway, go ahead.
We had Dr. Gerard McClendon, who calls, he's part of our family in Urban View. And I'm sure he'll call. I'm sure he's called in the mornings. He made an astute. He said, listen, rodents, we know rodents, right? Squirrels are rodents, right? Yeah. They're the same. Both parties the same. He said, so you look out your door, you see five squirrels on your lawn. You don't have a problem, right? Look out your door and you see five rats.
Right.
There's a difference.
They're
both rodents.
That's right.
Okay. So yes, they're the same, but they're not the same.
But then
when he made that analogy, I was like, that's perfect. Cause if I see one rat, we got a problem.
Because we've been socialized to see. And see, that's the challenge. To me, that analogy moves in the direction of perception. And that's what makes me worry about something like that. Because I remember at 5 or 6 years old, standing in Phoenix City, Alabama, with my daddy, my Uncle Aaron, my Uncle Doc, and a bunch of other grown men. And we just standing there, me and my brother. And I watched my Uncle Doc skin a squirrel to eat. To put in the pot. So not a cat, not a dog, but a squirrel. And a Vietnam dog can be eaten. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so it's all about perception. We react to rats that way because not only are they disease carriers and everything else, but we've been socialized to say, oh, rats. And I'm saying, like Malcolm's analogy of the fox and the wolf, they're the same. But here's the challenge. When you then say, as you say, why have we been socialized to think of that way about rats? Rats will bite you. Rats carry diseases. Squirrels don't typically come in your house and have nests. In other words, there are reasons behind the perception. Those parties aren't the same, and there are reasons behind the perception. I believe in contributing to the society I live in for resources because my mother and father lived on Social Security. You know, neither one of them made much money in their lives, and that federal pension was the difference between them and before we got to the age where we could earn enough to send back. Not even send back. To send to, back implies you've somehow gone past your parent. No, you know, but, you know, that was and remained a lifesaver and is for a lot of people. Your friends in the White Nationalist Party will privatize Social Security on the way to bankrupting and making sure that so many are in pure poverty. They are also anti-union and all many other things. There is a difference. You're absolutely right, Prof. There's a difference between squirrels and rats. Same family, but not the same. And there are substantive reasons behind that perception. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a problem. So thank you for making that analogy. It's very important for evoking it.
Okay, you were listening to a recording from Dr. Greg Carr from last Saturday in Class with Carr. And that was one segment, but I'm excited to share the second segment we're going to play today with Dr. Carr talking about James Earl Jones playing Paul Robeson. And only Dr. Carr could weave in so many different issues from Kendrick Lamar to Vernon Johns, the pastor of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church before Dr. King, even Frankie Beverly, and on. He weaves all of that in with a discussion of James Earl Jones playing Paul Robeson. I was particularly moved by knowing that James Earl Jones was a stutterer, very similar to Sonia Sanchez, whose birthday was last week. They both stuttered quite a bit as a child and didn't really speak until they were much older. It also reminded me of my dad, who just had his birthday the other day. And he was also a stutterer, and he didn't start speaking until he became a political activist and speaking out. But let's move in now into this clip from Dr. Carr talking about James Earl Jones playing Paul Robeson, weaving in many topics.
How do you confront absurdity? Race is an absurdity. Class is an absurdity. So the critique of the Marxists, the socialists, absolutely make perfect sense. The question is, how do you confront it? How do you grapple in the world we live in to create the world we want to live in? James Earl Jones is grappling with the same question we all grapple at. As a black man born in Mississippi, who then moved to Michigan, whose grandmother raised him, we said she was the most racist person I ever knew because she was Indian and black and she hated both sides, who grew up with his cousin, his auntie's son, Robert Earl, named for his father, Robert Earl, who was an actor who left the family to go pursue an acting career, and they reconciled later in life. And Robert Earl, who knew Paul Robeson, James Earl, who met but didn't know Paul Robeson, James Earl, who played Paul Robeson. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. This is the actual play by Philip Hayes Dean. I was looking for it Monday night, but I found it in time for class today, as I said I would when we were together Monday night, because this one I keep with me. James Earl Jones is grappling with the same challenge we're grappling with. How do you respond to absurdity? And his question on race here in the chapter Grendel, he's basically saying, you know, I try to grapple with it by being black, but I'm not going to let this blackness define my life. And he lived his life that way. And in both chats, I see people are putting in their favorite characters. We know, you know, James Earl Jones becomes raceless for a lot of people, except nobody's ever raceless. He's the blackness you can accept in a moment with the little chime coming in underneath and saying, this is CNN. Yeah, I feel good. Okay, you feel good. You a little scared when you hear Darth Vader's voice. Luke, I am your father. Okay, I get that too. Okay, and then the white folks love James Earl Jones. Here comes Ray Kinsella kidnapping terrorist man in Boston and taking him out to Iowa to the Field of Dreams. Baseball. What have Americans always turned to, Ray? Oh, people will come. They will come. They most certainly will. So you understand that James Earl Jones is comforting to those folks because it's a blackness that is at once like a teddy bear. It's not on the cutting edge like it was when he played Othello all the time. After Paul Robeson, after Ira Aldridge, it wasn't the blackness on the cutting edge when he played Jack Jefferson, the gloss of Jack Johnson, the ghost, of course, in the house, as Muhammad Ali's trainer, Drew Mundini Brown, would call him in The Great White Hope. You know, and it wasn't the blackness that black people love James Earl Jones for, whether it be Bingo Long's Traveling All-Stars, whether it be King Joffe Jafur.
Where is my son? My son works?
In other words, y'all love King Joffe Jafur, no question. We know James Earl Jones, the standard's there. And then there are the convergence of the governance formation, who Africans are to each other, and the social structure, like Mufasa in The Lion King. We understand. Or what we watched in that scene from Roots the Next Generation when James Earl Jones plays Alex Haley.
I found you, you old African, Kunta Kinte.
And we're all sitting there with tears in our eyes as this man connects those few generations that came after Kunta Kinte to all the generations that came before when he's in Guinea. It takes Leonard Jeffries to tell that story because he's one of the scholars that works on Roots. But the whole point, though, I want to find that in another chapter in this book, which I'm going to put James Earl Jones down after that. And that's the chapter before Grendel, chapter 17, The Robeson Ruckus and Ad Hoc Art. What is the Robeson Ruckus? There are people in both these chats and through the week who will watch this later who will remember this play. Paul Robeson, Philip Hayes Dean. This copy I found many years ago in a used bookstore. I was fortunate enough as I opened it, I think I paid maybe $3 for this, to have found in this copy, tucked inside the play by the great black playwright, Philip Hayes Dean. We did one of his plays at Tennessee State, Sty of the Blind Pig. Yes, the actual program from the October 1978 staging of Paul Robeson. James Earl Jones played Paul Robeson, as we know. Why did he play Paul Robeson, though? Why did he play Paul Robeson? He played Paul Robeson, as he writes in his memoir, Voices and Silences. This man who was a child had a stutter so bad he didn't talk for years. James Jones says this. He says, I had a twofold motive for playing Paul Robeson. One was as simple as my reason for needing to play Jack Jefferson in The Great White Hope. I'm going to fight the urge to say this in an imagined voice of, well, maybe. He says, there was a mountain to climb. Second, I wanted to do it for all the young.
and the not-so-young people who had not been fortunate enough to know Paul Robeson, even as little as I had. It was 1977. We lived without real heroes, without examples and alternatives. People, especially black people, searched desperately for alternatives. They craved heroes. Here was an epic hero.
Paul Robeson's, James Earl Jones said, the reason I played Paul Robeson was, it was a great thing, it's advancing my career after I did Late Great White Hope, but black people looking for heroes. Does that sound like a black man that don't understand he black? On page 249, he said, I was happy when people came to me backstage to say they had connected with Paul Robeson in our production. Women who had problems with their children came to me as if they felt that somehow, having played the man, I carried some of his mystique back to my dressing room with me. They approached me as if I had some of Paul's wisdom. My son has strayed. My daughter has this problem. Can you help? They were not seeking money. They were not seeking spiritual advice. The play had that kind of effect on people, but they sometimes did not separate the role and me. And that was disturbing. I saw how desperately they needed valid heroes. People often may believe that heroes can give clarity to their lives. There's an urgent need for that, especially among black people, and especially among black women, who, like women of most societies, have looked for men to lead the way, often to their great disappointment.
Does that understand Paul Robeson? That doesn't tell you that James Earl Jones doesn't have a glimpse of understanding the challenges of black people and black women? He said these black women were coming to him after the play to say, can you help me? You just played a strong figure, and my son needs that. Now, there are a lot of two-parent families, and there are a lot of families where the man isn't present or the woman isn't present, and the community steps in, so I'm not getting in that. That's a governance conversation. I'm very clear about that. I hope people know that I'm clear about that. What I'm speaking to is how James Earl Jones is confronting the absurdity of race. The clip that's circulating, that's a problem for a lot of people, myself included, but not really as much for me as maybe for many, because I understand this is an absurd situation we're living in. And in an absurd situation, sometimes you give up. Or sometimes you say, that's enough for me. Sometimes after you make an anthem that started as a rap beef, and I am entirely open to the possibility and would not at all be surprised that after your Super Bowl, the ones that some of y'all love so much, that's gonna be in New Orleans, and I understand y'all want Lil Wayne to perform. If there's a caring less than where I am now, I would like to know, because right now I don't think I could. I really do think I couldn't. People say I could care less. Well, that means you could care less. No, I couldn't care less about that. I won't be watching it. But the point is that, look, I would not be surprised at all if the reports come back, after which point I will then watch, because I am going to watch it at some point. I'm not going to contribute to the ratings, but I'll watch because I need to watch it. It's like I saw Snoop and them out there with them damn orange jumpsuits. But the point is that, the prison shake a leg, the prison minstrelsy at the Super Bowl initially, I would not be surprised, and watch Usher's command performance, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Kendrick come out and then Drake come out. And then if you think the hillbillies' heads exploded after Tuesday, some of y'all who think that Kendrick Lamar is some kind of champion, again, not his fault. There's no Paul Robeson in this generation because the times that Paul Robeson came of age don't exist. There's no James Earl Jones in the same way. People say, well, now the James Earl Jones, who's left? There's a lot of people left, but they come as products of their times. You remember Robert Earl Jones, his father, if you saw the opening scene of The Sting, Newman and Redford. You know, James Earl Jones, daddy Robert Earl Jones is in that opening. He's part of the scam that starts the movie. But the point is this. Kendrick, in this back and forth that started with now the anthem, They Like Us, and with every passing day, the they and the us gets less clear. If you hear the song he dropped Wednesday, I mean, I found out about Wednesday. We were in class at the law school. We're packing up. They done gone overtime. I love these young people. We arguing, discussing. I'm listening. They talking about reparations, how we can get it, how we cannot get it, going through the book chapter and verse, which is the thing I love the most at the Howard University School of Law. These students are reading and having this conversation. I'm just sitting back. I'm throwing provocative questions out. I'm listening. I'm taking notes. I ask something else. I say something else. And I'm just listening. Beauty, just the genius of it, the beautiful thing. And at the end, they pack it in. I'm going over 20 minutes. And here comes one or two of the undergraduates who comes to sit in regularly. They didn't come from the Congressional Black Caucus. And the young brother says, Kendrick done dropped a new song. I said, what? Okay, so I listened to it on the train there back home. And he starts that new untitled song. Has everybody in here who has heard it said, the one he dropped this week? I think it's time to watch the party die. What party? Democratic Party? No, he ain't talking about Democratic Party. He done let loose something in the world called They Not Like Us, and it's beyond him. So I'm listening to the lyrics. He said, this shit done got too wicked to apologize. It's different. Get him whacked and disqualified. We even kill the killers because they taking innocent lives. Burn a whole village. We start over. Is it really that time? Why reason with these N-words as if they can't see the future first? Again, different times call for different measures. I can imagine Paul Robeson using the N-word or calling women the B-word and being embraced as a culture hero. I can't imagine it. Him or Nina Simone. But again, not a critique, an observation. Cultural meaning making marks where the culture is at any given time and space. And when you say for the culture, I suspect it would have been something different for Dizzy Gillespie or Bessie Smith than it would be in this day and age. But we continue. He says, why argue with these clowns? If the circus is well at work, just walk that Mac down. Walk that man down. It'll do everyone a solid. It's love, but tough love sometimes got to result in violence. If you parade in gluttony without giving truth to the youth, the graveyard is company. Just tell us what casket to choose. He's grappling with, it seems to me, in this song, this untitled release, he's grappling with the aftermath of something that his ability, I'll stop short of genius, but if you want to say genius, I won't quibble with that. Let me just say the word for those who would say that. It's like a generation ago, people were telling me R. Kelly's a genius. Is he really? And now I'm not so sure. But actually, I'm pretty sure. But then again, the question wouldn't be whether I'm sure or not, but whether people who call him a genius is sure or not. But in his genius, Kendrick is now unleashed something in the world. And they not like us. They not like us. Who is the they? Who is the us? Because if the they is NFL owners, you damn right they not like you. And now you're going to shake the jangle leg in January at the Super Bowl. Who's the they? Who's the us again? And as people are going crazy, most of whom in that stadium have paid to get there, which means most of whom are in that stadium who have gotten corporate tickets to get there, which means most of them who are in that stadium don't look like you. Who is the they and who is the us, performer? So I wouldn't be surprised at all if Drake didn't come out. And they had a little mock beef right there on stage because maybe the whole thing's a mock beef. This is a fascinating release by young brother Kendrick Lamar. That's a fascinating release by KDOT that I listened to about 10 times since it came out, since I became aware of it on Wednesday. It's fascinating. How do you confront absurdity? Sometimes you turn inward. It seems to me this young brother's turning inward. It's a very interesting thing. It seems to me that Paul Robeson, portrayed by Jezreel Jones, did not turn inward. He confronted it head on. In this chapter 17 on Paul Robeson, James Earl Jones said, my daddy, Robert Earl, confronted me and said, I think Paul made the wrong choices. Paul Robeson was his friend. He said, the battle Paul Robeson engaged in against the state resulted in him being destroyed in many ways in terms of his public image, who he is to other people, and how in the governance formation, Black people treated him. I've stood in Big Bethel AME in Harlem, where his brother Ben was the pastor, where we talked about a long time ago how at Columbia's graduation in the spring, they had the Black graduation at AME Zion, Big Bethel, where Ben Robeson had been the pastor because they got a reputation of sheltering for Black people when other people won't do it. But many Black people backed up off him. So Paul Robeson had a choice. Here I stand. Robert Earl Jones said, I wouldn't have made the same choice. It would have paid the price. His son, Robert Earl Jones' son, James Earl Jones, played his father's friend and hero, Paul Robeson, on Broadway. And this whole chapter is devoted to what happened in the wake. Oh, man. James Earl Jones called hell because they said you watered down Paul Robeson. Did he? Let me see if I can find this quote right quick. Page 255, I think is where it's going. I don't like to write in my books. And I have an autographed copy of this somewhere, but I think it's in storage. He says, you have to understand that when you play Paul Robeson, you need to embrace his politics. They accused Philip Hayes Dean, the playwright, and most importantly, James Earl Jones, the one who brought Robeson to life in this play, of neutering Paul Robeson. You didn't deal with his politics. You want to talk about the sexuality. You want to talk about his craft and art. James Earl Jones responds, all of that is part of him. And no play is perfect. He said he got into an argument with a white woman about this. And in the argument back and forth, this is what the white woman said to James Earl Jones about Paul Robeson, who she was saying you did not portray him strong enough. She said, I effed Paul Robeson before you were born. I think I know what I'm talking about. Oh my God. Now you try to unravel that on a racial continuum, friends. Understand that this is absurd. I'll end with this on Paul Robeson and him. Carl Stokes, the journalist, before he became the mayor of Cleveland, interviewed James Earl Jones, who was his friend, about playing Paul Robeson on Broadway at a time when Paul Robeson Jr. came out against him, at a time when Coretta Scott King signed a petition against the play without seeing it and then came to see it and said, oh, this is okay. At a time when Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee came out against James Earl Jones for doing this. At a time, it's very important. Now, I'm saying all this as a backdrop to the point that we're talking about James Earl Jones this week, and we're talking about all the roles he played, but I promise you, a small fraction of people, probably most of them, people who lived through this period, even remember that he played Paul Robeson, and a smaller fraction of that remember that there was this huge controversy around the question of race, James Earl Jones, and his portrayal of Paul Robeson, a cultural mini maker for a previous generation, because the act of playing someone like that is an act of movement and memory, just like he played Vernon Johns in the Vernon Johns story. As far as I'm concerned, one of my favorite James Earl Jones portrayals of all of the many things he did was him playing the pastor of Dexter Avenue Church in Montgomery, the pastor who they put out before Martin Luther King came because he was too forward thinking for his time. So if you want to see a movie James Earl Jones was in, Soul Man, whatever, all them buddy movies at the end, whatever, all that stuff, fine. Go get the Vernon Johns story. One thing about James Earl Jones, he did play these iconic figures, and it allowed that embodiment to come forward. Carl Stokes concluded his commentary in the article he wrote. He said, quote, this is a play Americans need to see. Not because an actor rises to superlative heights in his portrayal of a character, which Jones does, but because this play reintroduces Paul Robeson to the American public and causes white and black Americans to confront the atrocious treatment that they accorded this remarkable man. Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee. Ruby Dee wrote this in the Black Press, the Amsterdam News, February 11th, 1978. A play about Paul Robeson at the Lunt Fontaines Theater comes then as if an answer to what is a great man. Perhaps we are beginning to feel the need for such a presence again in this time fast becoming void of greatness. James Earl Jones is Paul Robeson for us for a little while, giving us a powerful picture of a powerful man who walked among us and sang and tried to fight some battles and win some victories, and by doing so, to shore up our collective dignity as human beings. With the skilled assistance of the director Lloyd Richards, the difficult task of portraying a man very much alive in memory is well met. Philip Hayes Dean is the author of Paul Robeson, and he's opened the door for us to begin to look and measure and rediscover a beautiful man in a hard time, and we are grateful to him for ourselves and for all who missed Robeson in life. And then James Earl Jones says, that play brought me and my daddy together closer than we'd ever been. Remember, his father left when he was a little boy to go find his craft as an actor. And then they reunited as adults in New York. And he said, this brought me together because my father knew Paul Robeson. He's one of his heroes. Understand the complication of who we are to other people and who we are to each other. And in that Africana Studies framework within the governance formation conversations, Paul Robeson's son did not like it, but Paul Robeson's friends didn't like part of it, like other parts of it, but everybody agreed that it reopened Paul Robeson for a next generation. They want to impress me, they need to do it again. So, to wind up, I think we have to understand that in a moment of absurdity, when Beyonce can go full on country and set off a firestorm in governance structure conversations, and the social structures say, we don't give a damn what you do. We ain't giving you no one of our country music awards because it's our high holy grail and you ain't gonna get them. In a society where we all remember James Earl Jones for all the things, and now they're saying he got an EGOT, except the Oscars he got were honorary because he never won it for a role he played in life, which reinforces the idea that we should have our own awards and value them more than any award anybody gives to them, even when the DEI crew shows up and it's a bunch of people who look like us voting, but who also want to preserve their viability in that system. In a moment when we understand that there was a debate that took place this week and the performance of the sitting vice president her being herself more often than not. I cracked up when she was in North Carolina this week and she was talking and you heard some noise. And I'm thinking, okay, here's where she's going to have to address that Palestine question. She really didn't address during the debate, but gave the canned answer that politicians give. She's going to have to do it. And instead of that, it wasn't the Palestinian, it wasn't the protest about the slaughter in Palestine. Whatever it was, she said this from the podium. I'm sure many of y'all see that. She said, I see you, Newt. Oh, Kamala Harris is getting comfortable. This is fascinating to me because the more comfortable she gets, the more I think we're going to see the Kamala Harris that we want to see, because now there are non-white people who are also comfortable with it. And the guy on the other side has dropped all the pretenses like he did at the beginning of the 2016 campaign. And we can have a clear choice between a purebred racist Klansman and a human being. At that point, that human being probably has more space to be more fully human in the world. And I think there'll be even more of that as we move forward. And so we have to remember, and I'll end with this. Yesterday was being the anniversary of the assassination of Bantu Stephen Biko in South Africa at 30 years old. I watched with my students, not yesterday, 2 days ago, because I watched with students part of the Steve Biko Memorial Lecture, which is held every September in South Africa. They were at Nelson Mandela University this time. I was very honored to give a paper at the Steve Biko Symposium in 2007. I had showed my students that I had taken to South Africa. We had taken to South Africa, Dr. Dana Williams, myself, we had taken them to South Africa, and I showed them how to write an abstract for an academic conference. That was one of the lessons that I was teaching in class. And I said, I'm going to write one too, because I had gotten up that morning, as I always got up 4:00 in the morning and walked down to Rondebosch Road in Cape Town and bought all the newspapers and sit up and talk with the people and read the newspaper in the morning. I'm going to read the newspaper wherever I am. And that was a beautiful thing to do for 2 weeks in South Africa with South Africans, reading the paper and asking about this and that. And I saw an advertisement for the Steve Biko conference. I saw it was a Biko conference. So I clipped it out and I brought it to class. I said, let's all write abstracts. So I sent my abstract in. And I got a response from Nkosimathe Biko, the director, the son of Steve Biko, and the organization he runs, the Steve Biko Foundation in Joburg, saying that we would like to invite you to be one of the people who gives a paper at the conference. So I came back to South Africa that September and delivered that paper. So it has a special place in my heart to be able to be in that space, to be able to sit and listen and talk with former African heads of state about the questions and the problems facing Africa. Jerry Rawlings was alive at the time, former president of Ghana, the great Kenneth Kaunda, president of South Africa. Thabo Mbeki at the time was president of South Africa. And to be there to understand and help deepen the understanding that politicians are politician friends. And whether you're in the United States or on the continent of Africa, the Caribbean, Europe, anywhere else, Latin America, the choices you make aren't the choices that you would have made if you weren't in office. And prophets don't run for president. Sometimes you can converge the two and get close, but not as close as you would like to be in your heart of hearts. But we watched the Biko conference, a part of it, on Thursday afternoon, because they were live streaming it from Nelson Mandela University. And it forced me back into a reflective mode as the students were asking questions, as we watched young South Africans push back against the lecturer who was presenting at the time. And if I can, I'm gonna end with this if I can find it, but I think I took it out of my bag, which is a real tragedy, because you know me, I'm gonna obsess until I can find it. And I don't think I'm gonna be able to find it quickly, because I think I didn't. Ah, that's too bad. Yeah, anyway, there's a new book out that's a retrospective on the presidency of Nelson Mandela. And I keep it around here, but after we watched the Biko conference, I pulled it out and I've had it in my bag all day yesterday, and it's gonna bother me, but I don't think I'm gonna be able to find it, because I found it right here now. It's called Reassessing Mandela, Southern African Studies.
This is undefeated.
Yeah. Well, like I said, problem prop is that I took so much stuff. I mean, thousands of books in the storage. And now there are things that I know I took the stories that I want, and things that I know I have here that I kept for reasons. But when they're moving stuff, I move stuff around. And so I had to go looking for it. So when this happens, I feel that thing rises up that's been in my spirit for the last few months, which is, damn, did I leave? No, that's here. Okay, what did I do with it? And so even when I know what I did with it, I got that. It's like a phantom limb, the books. But this is a book that's very critical of Nelson Mandela. and also very celebratory of him. And it's a reminder that Nelson Mandela was a freedom fighter who became a politician. Kamala Harris is a politician who never had to be a freedom fighter. People want her to be a freedom fighter, don't understand politics. You want her to do something that you have to do. Mm-hmm. And the more we get involved, the more we can shape any politician to be or do what we want. So if people say, well, how do we confront this absurdity we live in? First of all, it has to be a we. We have to regroup and group ourselves, and then we have to take it head on. And so those are some of the things that flow through my mind this week. Mm. Anyway. So
not anyway.
Every way. Oh, I should mention this. Frankie Beverly, we'll talk about maybe him some more. Because everybody's playing Frankie Beverly. Like I said, I can't wait to see these HBCU bands and what they're gonna do with Frankie Beverly. The thought of Frankie Beverly that I had this week stemmed from the first time I saw him back in him perform in Maze back in the 80s in Dallas, Texas. I was down there. He and Patti LaBelle were on the same building.
So it was a Budweiser Superfest. It had to be.
It must have been. Come on, Rob. Yeah. And you know where I'm going because I've never been to Essence Fair. Is that where you saw him there?
I saw him in Jersey at a Budweiser Superfest. Rick James was the headliner.
Rick James and Frankie Beverly.
Yeah, and I'm a teenager. You know, by the time Rick James came, marijuana was all throughout. I'm sitting there like top row in the Giant Stadium.
Oh, no.
In a contact high.
All the smoke. The
but yeah, it was Sister Sledge, Frankie Beverly and Maze, The Whispers.
No!
Shalamar, I think, was there.
That, oh!
The Superfest was.
All in good form. You know what? Remember that scene in Batman when Heath Ledger comes out and tells this town deserves a better class of criminal? He said, this generation deserves the generations that we saw.
Yeah.
I mean, just that lineup, not as an oldies tour, but like in the prime of their, oh man.
Yes. So you had Patti LaBelle.
Patti LaBelle and Frankie Beverly is what I remember. It must've been Budweiser. You're absolutely right. And as you said, when you go there and Rick James is there, it's going to be like when you see George Clinton. You're getting a contact high. Just get your mind right when you go. Because mothership's not landing without, and you at the top, that means all of the smoke. This is not Jack and them and all the smoke podcast. No, all that smoke hits you. Oh, my God. Which, you know, but I tell you, the thing about it, just like that, just like what you saw and what we've all seen in those spaces. Frankie Beverly, and one thing I told my students this week was the other time I felt that most viscerally and directly, not even Stevie Wonder, Earth, Wind & Fire, which is the same, but Frankie Beverly and Maze specifically was when I was in Brazil, in Salvador, in Bahia, and there's a group called Oladum, which is a big band, but they're also like a social movement. They do social welfare stuff, but they're brilliant performers.
Okay, we got to cut that off there with Dr. Carr. You can listen In Class with Carr. It's available free online, In Class with Carr on YouTube. That was from this Saturday, September 14th. He goes on to wrap it back with James Earl Jones and Paul Robeson. I highly encourage people to check it out. Both the play that he talks about that James Earl Jones played Paul Robeson, as well as the film that he discussed about Vernon Johns, who was the preacher in Montgomery, Alabama, in the church before Dr. King was there. Both of them can be found online. So check it out if you have time. I want to give a special thanks not only to Dr. Carr, but to Magic Mike, our wonderful engineer, and to Crystal, who helped me edit these clips with Dr. Greg Carr. We're going to go out with a little clip with James Earl Jones from the play about Paul Robeson. And he begins by singing a song and making some comments. And you can hear he does sound like Paul Robeson, wishing everybody a healthy and positive week ahead. Stay strong. And again, as Dr. Carr says, we have to be reflecting on how do we respond to absurdity in this society of ours. So let's hear James Earl Jones playing Paul Robeson.
little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Paul Robeson. I'm sorry I can't be with you tonight in Carnegie Hall. That's why I prepared this tape. I am deeply honored that my likeness by my friend Antonio Salemi will be dedicated tonight in this great hall. I can think of no finer birthday present for my 75th year than this gathering of my friends, and I thank you. I salute my friends of all nations. I want you to know that I'm the same Paul, dedicated as ever to the worldwide cause of humanity for freedom, peace, and brotherhood. As Joe Hill says in the song, I'm with you still.
WPFW's This Is Reggae Music and the Reggae Experience presents a fundraising concert featuring Image Band, Curlew Reggae All-Stars Band, Lady Flame, and Carl Malcolm on Saturday, October the 5th, 7 p.m. until midnight at King Solomon Lodge, 2245 Rhode Island Avenue, Northeast Washington, D.C. Tickets available at Eventbrite by searching WPFW. All proceeds benefit WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words, Beats, and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults, with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Bethesda Theater presents the SOS Band on Friday and Saturday, September 20th and 21st. Spyro Gyral celebrating their 50th anniversary on Sunday, October 13th, and Norman Brown on Sunday, October 20th. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings, here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
Code Pink Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world.